Psalm 37, 40 verses, and we're going to make some progress, I hope, again today, and pursue our study through the Psalms. Psalm 37. The context of this psalm is, as we have on the board, the security of those who trust in the Lord. We note that as the psalmist expresses in this passage, verse 1, he said, "Fret not thyself because of evildoers, neither be thou envious against them that work unrighteousness." Similar to the psalm that Asaph wrote in Psalm 73. And in that psalm, the perplexing, we're going to come to this two or three times in our study of this psalm, maybe more. But the perplexity that he seemed to experience when he looked upon the evildoers and their lives seemed to be going well and they seemed to be blessed, and he did not understand how on earth these things could be so. And he was trying to serve the Lord, and it all seemed to be an effort of vanity. It wasn't being very productive, and he was suffering and afflicted. You need some heat back there, Lynn? Let me go grab that. Be right back. I know what it is to be cold, and there's no point in being back there and being cold. But we talked about Asaph, and he just didn't understand how that these people seem to prosper, and when I try to do what's right, I'm suffering, and just didn't seem like things were equitable to him until he went into the house of the Lord. And then he saw that God is right, God is just, and our service to him is certainly rewarded. Now, the psalmist, he expresses these thoughts a lot of times in the Psalms. This is another example of that, so that you don't fret because of the evildoer. And the word fret, I know that's been discussed. We think of fretting as just wringing your hands in worry, and that's not how the word is used here. It's used here to talk about anger, that when I see the unrighteous seemingly being blessed for what they're doing, and that makes me mad. And we've emphasized so many times in the first part of this psalm that when you get mad, that's not when you do your best work, is it? You generally mess up, and so here's the thought. Now, the writer says in verse 8, "Cease from anger, forsake wrath, fret," this is extreme anger, "not thyself, it tendeth only to evil doing, for evil doers shall be cut off." Now, if you're the fellow that gets mad because you look at the evildoer and he seems to be prospering and you don't, and that makes you mad, who does that make you? That makes you one of them. Now, don't miss that point. That's the purpose of this whole thing. It makes you the evildoer. So if you're mad at the evildoer because he seems to be blessed and you're not, then if that makes you mad, then that makes you the evildoer. And sometimes we don't see ourselves in that light, but that's exactly how the psalmist paints us. Now, in our study thus far, we've identified in verses 10 through the next several verses that the righteous seem to be subjected to the onslaught of wicked people, but God does not suffer the righteous to be overcome. This gets back to choice. You have choice about your life. Yes, we note that the apostle in writing to Timothy in 2 Timothy 3 verse 12 said that all who live godly shall suffer persecution. Now, can we accept that as a fact, or does that make us mad? Sometimes it makes us mad. And that's what the psalmist is writing about. Don't let that disturb you to the point that it makes you mad. And in the world in which we live today, do we not get angry when things like that happen, like somebody trying to run through the front end of the church building? And you see, these kind of things tend to irritate us, don't us? And so the point being is, I can't let that sidetrack me. Too cold back there? I can't let that sidetrack me. I've got a purpose. And the purpose in my life is to try to serve God, and that's a purpose that I've chosen. And we need to stay on course with that, okay? And that's as simple as this psalm can be put. When we drop down into the next several verses, we note that the righteous will be vindicated, and the wicked, they will have their day. Their day will certainly come. And if you'll pick up the reading at verse 16, it says, "Better is a little than the righteous hath, than the abundance of many wicked. For the arm of the wicked shall be broken, but Jehovah upholdeth the righteous. Jehovah knoweth the day of the perfect, and the inheritance shall be forever. They shall not be put to shame in the evil time, and in the days of famine they shall be satisfied." Now, we talked about that in our earlier study, and I tried to emphasize that those who do what's right, they will receive their inheritance. Time of shame, they'll not receive evil. Days of famine, they'll be satisfied. You'll have what you need. Now, that's the point that the writer is climbing to as we jumped ahead in our study last week and looked at verse 25. You'll have what you need. Now, does that mean you won't ever suffer? You won't ever be punished? Oh, no. No, when you look at those in Hebrews chapter 10, beginning about verse 32, look at what they suffered because of their faith. When you look at the Apostle Paul in 2 Corinthians chapter 11, beginning in verse 23, these passages ring a bell to most all of you. Yes? If not, we'll read them. But Paul said, look at what I suffered already. And the dating of that was before he'd ever been arrested in the city of Jerusalem. He talks about how that he'd been beaten with rods, night and day had been in the deep. You're familiar with that passage. And besides all this, he says there is the anxiety for all the churches. And so we've got all of this existed in the life of the Apostle Paul because of his doing righteous. Now, if that's all you see, and it's easy to get bogged down in that, isn't it? You ever had kind of a stretch of things that just didn't seem to be going right at all? And it's easy to get discouraged and bogged down in all. Well, it's easy to be up when everything's going fine, isn't it? But when you go through a siege of things, maybe even a year or 2 years or more, when everything seems to be happening and it's not on the good side, it's easy to get discouraged and sometimes become angry. And some folks even become angry with God because of that. Until we look to the latter end. You see, if this is all I see, now listen carefully to this point. It's not a bad thing to see bad things happening to you. Yeah, we need to be vigilant and see the things that are going around about us. But if that's all you see, now what does it become? An obsession, a distraction, and now you're the wicked fellow. You're the evil one. And that's hard to see ourselves in that light. Well, we're good. We're members of the Lord's church. And so we're not going to be overwhelmed by those. But yet we did, don't we? Because we live in a wicked world. And sometimes we begin to think like the world thinks. And let us never think that we're not influenced by the way that others think. Now, we talked about some of these things in our study last week. So I want to quickly move on. In verse 20. Verse 20, it says, "But the wicked shall perish, and the enemies of Jehovah shall be as the fat of lambs. They shall consume, and smoke shall they consume away." Now, contrast to the wicked. The wicked's going to perish. The enemies of the Lord, they're going to be like a fat lamb. What happens to a fat lamb? What do you do with a fat lamb? Eat him. Eat him. Yeah, yeah. So they're going to be consumed. And that's a very simple point that he makes. The wicked perish at the presence of God. And the text, I think, is quite impressive when it uses the expression, "In smoke shall they consume away." Now, you ever have a document or something that needs to be destroyed? Now, I know we talk about pollution and all that kind of, we're kind of limited on what we can do. But do you ever burn something to get rid of it? Burn it. You know what burning it does? It decomposes it quickly. That's what the process of burning something, it's decomposed, all right, but quickly. Now, what happens to the wicked? They vanish away, and it'll be quick, you see. The point being is God's judgment will be like a puff of smoke, and we see that kind of terminology used in the 68th chapter, verse 2. So the wisdom writer, again in Proverbs 14:32, the wicked is thrust down in his evil doing, but the righteous hath a refuge in his death. That's interesting, isn't it? What does it tell you about trusting the Lord? Oh, you're going to always understand everything that happens. It's always going to make sense to you, right? No. Now, in times when it don't make sense, what do? Get mad? No, that don't answer anything. You trust the Lord. Now, remember, the Apostle Paul, writing from Roman prison, said in Philippians 4, verse 13, I can do all things in him that strengtheneth me. I don't know of anybody that writes any more upbeat than the Apostle Paul does, who has suffered like he has suffered. Now, on that note, let's not put the Apostle Paul even on a pedestal. Because even the Apostle Paul realized the possibility of temptation. Everybody with me on that? Let's turn over, if you will, to the, where is it that I want to be? The Ephesian letter, the sixth chapter. The Ephesian letter in the sixth chapter. And look, beginning in verse 19, as the apostle is calling upon the Ephesians to pray for him. Now, where is Ephesians written from? Where is Paul? He's in prison. Yeah, he's in prison. And in verse 19 he says, and on my behalf, he's talking about praying, making supplication, and on my behalf, that utterance may be given unto me in the opening of my mouth to make known with boldness the mystery of the gospel, for which I am an ambassador in chains, that in it I may speak boldly as I ought to speak. Now, what would imprisonment, as Paul acknowledges, what would it perhaps cause him to do?
Complain.
Yeah. Be discouraged. Yeah. But what's he calling upon the Ephesians to do for him? Pray for what? Be bold. Yeah. Help me to be bold and to say the things that I need to say. And I'll tell you, as a gospel preacher, and this is not just applicable to gospel preachers, sometimes you have occasion to be talking to somebody that is adversarial. And it's not easy to always be bold. Sometimes you just want to get through it. Okay? I was preaching on one occasion on a subject that's quite controversial, and the local preacher, he was not a friend of mine. I believe he taught error in many respects. But he became so aggravated at me and the things that I was trying to preach that he got up and left and went to his office in the back of the building till it was done. Now, what would that do to you? Here you are trying to teach what God's Word says, and the local preacher gets up and makes a demonstration. That's kind of like, this is my way of protesting what you're saying. Well, that's mild. But when you go into a circumstance like that where you know it's adversarial, Donna and I went to preach at a place one time that we knew had some issues, and I was asked to deal with some of those things. And the arrangement with a friend of ours was that we'd go over to their house. They were going to have a potluck after service Sunday morning. And so anybody had any questions or something they wanted to talk with me about, that would be a relaxed environment that asked questions, right? That sound reasonable? No, it wasn't too relaxing for us, because when we got there, you would have thought we had the plague. Nobody wanted to talk to us. Nobody wanted to sit with us. I mean, even the folks who were hosting the thing were aggravated with us. There's some other circumstances. Family members of theirs were involved in this mess. And so teaching the truth don't always make friends. And Paul certainly experienced that. Now, does it take an effect upon you? Does it potentially take an effect on you? Well, yeah, I want to call your attention to a passage that has drawn my attention on more than one occasion. Turn with me to 2 Corinthians chapter 1. Now, we study 1 Corinthians, I know, a lot, but we don't study 2 Corinthians quite as extensively as we do 1 Corinthians. But in 2 Corinthians, we need to know where Paul is when he's writing it. He's on his way to Jerusalem. Keep in mind now, he's written 1 Corinthians from Ephesus over here in Asia. And he's going up the side of the Aegean Sea, comes up to Troas, and then he travels into Macedonia. Now, writing the first epistle, we note that there were a lot of things that he addresses. Almost every chapter, there's some controversial issue. And he travels on up into Macedonia, where he writes the second epistle. And in the first epistle, you recall, he's instructed them to get ready the contribution for the needy saints in Jerusalem. But in the second epistle, he revisits that in chapters 8 and 9. And tells them, I'm on my way and I'm sending folks ahead of me to make sure you've got this ready so that when I go to Jerusalem, we'll have it all done, you see. But now in the second epistle, in the first chapter, he says, beginning in verse 8, he said, For I would not have you ignorant, brethren, concerning the afflictions which befell us in Asia. Now, it's my opinion, that's all it is. We don't know where in Asia that he's referencing, but we do know that Ephesus is in Asia, the place from which he wrote the first epistle. And we know what happened to him when he was in Ephesus, don't we? You remember how that he was taken, or his friends were taken down to the arena, something like a coliseum, and there they were tormented, perhaps troubled by the lions or gladiators or things such as that. This was the kind of thing that was taking place at the time. And Paul was pleaded with by his friends, don't you go down there. So he didn't, but here's what he says. Now, perhaps it was Ephesus, I don't know, but it was somewhere in Asia. He said that we were weighed down exceedingly beyond our power, insomuch that we despaired even life. Now, describe that to me.
We were dead.
Yeah. He said, yea, we ourselves have had the sentence of death within ourselves, that we could not trust in ourselves, but in God who raiseth the dead, who delivered us out of so great of death, and will deliver, on whom we have set our hope, that he will also still deliver us. Ye also helping together in our behalf by your supplication, by your prayers, that for the gift bestowed upon us by means of many, thanks may be given by many persons on our behalf. Now, what does that say about the Apostle Paul and persecution that he identifies in 2 Corinthians chapter 11 in some detail? But here in the first chapter, just one incident. What can that do to you? You see other folks who are wicked people and they're doing this to you. Life seems good to them, but it's certainly not to you. And that can become very discouraging, can't it? Sometimes, perhaps, as he expressed here, make you just want to quit. Well, you can't do that. So the wicked is thrust down in his evil doing, but the righteous hath a refuge. And we don't ever need to forget that. There is a refuge for those who are righteous. Now, in verses 21 and 22 of this text, we didn't look much at this. We jumped down to 25. But in verse 21, it says, The wicked borroweth and payeth not again, but the righteous dealeth graciously and giveth. For such as are blessed of him shall inherit the land, and they that are cursed of him shall be cut off. Now, here we just got a simple principle. What does the wicked man do? He borrows and often has no intentions of repaying. Don't plan on repaying. He's going to take it.
That's called stealing.
That's called stealing. Yeah, that's what that is. Well, that's kind of why he's a wicked man. You know, W.T. Brench wrote a book several years ago called Salvation or Salvation from Sin. And he's got a chapter in it on the subject of repentance. And in that chapter, he gives a very good illustration of repentance. He said, a man that continues to ride my horse without my permission has not repented of stealing my horse. That's simple. If he continues to ride him without my permission, he's not repented of stealing my horse. Well, now here's the wicked man. He doesn't have any intentions of changing things. He's going to take your horse or whatever he takes, and he's not planning on giving it back. That's stealing. That's the wicked man. But now the righteous man, he deals graciously and gives. What did the Lord say about that? When the man says, I want to borrow your cloak, give him your coat also. Okay? He said, for such are blessed of him that shall inherit the land. But they that are cursed of him shall be cut off. Now who's cursed of him? This wicked man up here that has no intentions of paying his debts. He borrows and he doesn't pay it back. So the writer said the wicked is cursed by the Lord and he shall be cut off. Now have you noticed how many times, even in this psalm, the same thing is stated over and over and over and over. Now I know you probably hear lessons that you've heard before. I know that so. And I know, as sure as I'm standing here, that when I'm preparing what I call a brand new lesson, there are parts and points that are made in other lessons that become a part of this lesson because it's a valid point that needs to be established as a part of this subject study. Now, is that a good thing or a bad thing? I think it's an exceptionally good thing. That's why I do that. I was told by a fellow in the military many years ago, he said, in the military, we've got three rules for learning. Repetition, repetition, and repetition. And I believe that's right. We hear it often enough, before long, some of it kind of begins to stick. And I believe that's exactly right. So look at this psalm. Now what's his point? The wicked man, he's going to be cursed of the Lord. He'll be cut off. Now back up at verse 9 and look at it there. For the evildoers shall be cut off, but those that wait for Jehovah shall inherit the land. Look at verse 11. He said, but the meek shall inherit the land and shall delight themselves in the abundance of peace. What about the evildoer? He won't. See, he's going to be cut off. In verse 18, you've got the same thing again. Jehovah knoweth the days of the perfect and the inheritance shall be forever. Well, what about those who are not? Well, they're going to be cut off. Now, you see this becoming a repetitive theme. In verse 29, for example, the righteous shall inherit the land and dwell therein forever. The wicked are going to be cut off. You'll look again at verse 34, same point. Wait for Jehovah and keep his way, and he will exalt thee to inherit the land. When the wicked are cut off, thou shalt see it. Now, here's just one psalm that makes the same point several times. Now, why do you suppose he did that? Why not just say it once and forget it? Have you noticed how many times that the apostles in the writing of the epistles said the same exact thing? Over and over and over. We call Ephesians and Colossians parallel books. Why? It's not just because they're written from the same place. But the same points are repeated in both books many times. Why didn't he just say it once and forget it?
Because it was important.
Yeah. It needs to be said over and over and over to this group, this group, this group, and then exchange letters and read it all again. Because it's important. Now, I tell you what, brethren, I think sometimes we get tired of hearing it. I expect maybe they did too. But if you hear it often enough, do you eventually make a personal application of it and say, maybe I need to change this? And you know what, brethren? I think sometimes in the circumstance of our own life, we might have heard this 10 years ago. And now the circumstances in my life are different. And when I'm hearing it again, it's from a different perspective. Maybe I'll make an application of it this time around. All right, Noah?
So it's like my dad used to tell us when we were kids, you know, we bust a bike and I want to go to church. You know, we play sticks sometimes. My dad would say, you know what? As long as you, I said, why would you force someone to go who doesn't want to go? And he says, well, as long as you were here, something and it gets in your head and you hear it, it might stick.
Yeah. Yeah.
It did, you know, it did.
I might hear it a little differently today than what I heard it last week. You see, things happen. And circumstances of my life sometimes make me sit up and pay attention when otherwise I did not. Good point. Good point. Now we've got the second part of this, just simply repeated this, the other side, the righteous. Now, when you look at Matthew 25, somebody tell me, what are we reading here in Matthew 25, beginning in verse 31? What is that?
Judgment.
Judgment. Yes, sir. That's the judgment scene. Tell me about the judgment scene. You don't have to read it. Just tell me what it's about in that passage.
I can't remember if the sheep and the goats are earlier or if that's where they are.
That's where they are. Yeah. We've got all nations gathered before him. And a great separation takes place, the sheep and the goats. Now, those on the right hand, the sheep, what do they ask? Well, what are they told? Come on, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. Then what do they ask? Why? And what are they told? Same answer. Why? They're told why. You see. But those on the left hand, they are told to depart from me, ye cursed, into eternal fire, prepared for the devil and his angels. And what's their question? Why? And then what are they told? They're told why. And then when we come down to verse 46, we see the result of eternal life to those who are righteous and those who are not, eternal damnation. Now, that's just it in a summation. But isn't this the same thing that we read in Psalm 37? Same thing. Now, this is not the only New Testament passage, by the way, that you can read of those things. But it's one. Yeah.
Jesus was the master teacher.
He was.
He was able to make sense of what we read in the Psalm.
Yeah.
Because what does it mean that evil will be cut off? You know, that from a very practical standpoint, in our day-to-day life, I know a lot of evil people, I've never seen them cut off.
Yeah. Yeah, see, that was the problem that Asaph had until he went into the house of the Lord and he saw the end.
Right, so that's what Jesus is showing us
at
the end.
This
is
the end.
Here's how it ends.
Here's how it ends. This is, as Paul Harvey says, the rest of the story.
Yeah. It makes sense. It makes the Psalm make sense.
Now, most of you in this audience know who Paul Harvey was, but that was his thing. The rest of the story. Now, you know. And that's what Jesus is saying here. And you'd like to think that when, of course, David, being the author of this, hadn't happened just exactly yet. But even some of his own experiences, he ought to have known this principle. His experiences with Saul, his experience with Absalom. But then when you get on a little further, you're talking about the history of the nation of Israel, the Assyrian captivity. Why'd that happen? Because of their idolatry. Who told them it would happen? Well, Moses did several times. Joshua did several times. And as you look at these things, we're looking at the ultimate end here. But you see, the promise to the wicked that everything is going to be rosy, even in this life, that promise not made. You reap what you sow, and if you don't reap it now, you'll reap it later. And that's the way of it. And the psalmist is wanting us to understand that. Okay. Well, let's go on just a little. Verse 23 and 24 says, a man's goings are established of Jehovah, and he delighteth in his way. Though he fall, he shall not be utterly cast down, for Jehovah upholdeth him with his hand. Oh, such an interesting passage. You know, when we look at a passage like this one, and certainly we see all of the Calvinists make hay out of that. Yeah, well, they try to. They try to. A man's goings are established of Jehovah. Now, we want to comment on some of this. First of all, it tells us that the man's goings are established of Jehovah. What man? In this context, what man?
Righteous
man. The righteous man. His goings are established of Jehovah, and he delighteth in his way. Who delights in his way? God does. He delights in his way. Though he fall, he shall not be utterly cast down, for Jehovah upholdeth him with his hand. That's a very interesting expression. It's one that we sing about. You remember the song that he holds us in the palm of his hand? So this is not a strange thought and likely where the song comes from. But how do we understand, though he fall, he shall not be utterly cast down, for Jehovah upholdeth him with his hand? Who is this man? Now think carefully. Who is this man that God upholds with his hand? The righteous man. Now, what does the righteous man do when he messes up? Does it mean he never sins? or he repents, and God upholds him. Now, the steps of a good man, here's the man that we're talking about, and are established with the Lord, when he delights in his way. Now, that gives a little different slant on it, that it's not God that delights in his way, but rather that the good man delights in the way of God. So you can go that either way, but the application is, wherever you wind up, it's still the same. You've got the good man doing what's right. Why? Well, that pleases God. Now, what's the result of that? You see, Asaph, we go back to Asaph so many times in this. Asaph said, in this perplexity that he has when he sees the good man seeming to be suffering and the unrighteous man seeming to be suffering, he said, I don't understand that. Until I went into the house of the Lord. And as he continues in that, he says, thou hast holden me by my right hand. The wording even of the American Standard Translation, I think is perhaps even to be questioned. Thou hast holden me by thy right hand is not as some commentators express it this way, not as the Lord upholds him. In other words, here's a man that's a righteous man, but he messes up and the Lord's holding him up. No, that's the Calvinistic teaching. But rather, the Lord is the one who holds his hand. I am with you. Now, does that mean the Lord's with you when you're doing evil? No, but he's with you when you change your mind and begin to do the right things. Much like David. God was not with David when he was committing adultery with Bathsheba. But what was it that was noteworthy about David? He was a man after God's own heart.
God sent me to him.
Yeah, and when he realized what he did, then he said, I have sinned. Now, God's holding his hand when he's walking that path, you see. And he'll hold yours too when you walk that path. But what if you abandon that path? God's not happy with you, and you shouldn't be happy with you. Okay? Now, these are familiar passages. Jeremiah 10:23, what's it say?
Not in man that directs his steps.
All right, not in man that walketh to direct his own steps. So whose steps, who needs to direct your steps? The Lord does. Yeah.
Jesus is the way.
He is the way. And you can look at these texts from Psalms and Proverbs, essentially saying the same thing. Point is, the righteous will not be destroyed when he gets back on the right path. Now let's turn over to this text in 2 Corinthians 4. Look at it just a bit. 2 Corinthians 4, beginning at verse 8. 2 Corinthians 4, the whole chapter is just as intriguing as it can be. He starts out by pointing out that if the gospel is veiled, it's veiled by whom and in whose mind? It's veiled, where's my passage? Verse 4, in whom the God of this world hath blinded the minds of the unbelieving, that the light of the gospel of the glory of Christ, who is the image of God, should not dawn upon them. If our gospel is veiled, verse 3, it is veiled in them that perish. Why? They're being led by the God of this world, and so they don't get it. But dropping down in the text to our point, verse 7 beginning, he said, but we have this treasure in earthen vessels, that the exceeding greatness of the power may be of God and not from ourselves. We are pressed on every side, yet not straitened, perplexed, yet not unto despair, pursued, yet not forsaken, smitten down, yet not destroyed, always bearing about in the body the dying of Jesus, that the life also of Jesus may be manifest in our body. For we who live are always delivered unto death for Jesus' sake, that the life also of Jesus may be manifest in our mortal body. And so, what is our point? Well, there's going to be times of affliction. There'll be times of discouragement. There'll be times of persecution. But what do we need to remember during those times?
Eyes on the prize.
That's right. Keep your eye on the prize. Lord, not going to desert you. Keep your eye on the prize and keep on working. All right. Thank you, Noah. Well, let's look at the next couple of verses in our text. Verse 25 and 26. I have been young and now am old, yet have I not seen the righteous forsaken, nor his seed begging bread. All the day long he dealeth graciously and lendeth, and his seed is blessed. This is a powerful text. The writer is writing from a perspective of experience. I've been young and now I'm old. And what have I learned? Well, what have you learned? Some of you who are young, much younger than some of the rest of us, you've just not lived enough years to have some of the experiences that some who are older have had. And that's not to fuss at you or blame you for anything. That's just fact. You haven't lived enough years. Now, when somebody says that to you, does that become offensive? Insulted by that? Well, keep in mind we shouldn't be, no, because we've all been young. We've all been inexperienced. And we've all learned, hopefully, if we've lived long enough, from some of those experiences, not to pursue some of the paths that we started out pursuing. Now, the writer says, I've been young, now I'm old, but what have I learned? God don't forsake his.
I just can say young and old is a relative term.
Oh, it is, yeah.
Depending on your perspective.
Yeah.
Carolyn told me she had a second grader ask her how old she was. She said, how old do you think I am? She said, 90.
Yeah.
Second grade, everybody's old.
Everybody's old, yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, that's true. My dad was 55 when I was born, and I never thought about him being old, although he was. I never thought about him being old until his health began to decline and he couldn't do what he used to do. And then I think about the age that I am now would put him about the age that I am now while I was a teenager. And I thought, oh, boy.
We don't know how old David was.
We don't know how old. All we know is he says he's old. I don't know how old at the time of this writing. But I think it's interesting to note what he has learned. He's never seen the righteous forsaken, nor his seed. That's an interesting concept, an interesting additional note. Nor his seed begging bread. Now, what does the man who is righteous, what does he do? All the day long he dealeth graciously and lendeth, and his seed is blessed. Now, question. I want you to think on this. From your experiences, when you talk about the righteous man, he may not have a whole lot. You ever know anybody like that? Didn't have a whole lot. But if you needed something, he'd give you the shirt right off his back. That's just the way it is. He's gracious, and he lendeth, and his seed is blessed. Now, is the Lord like that? Lord's righteous, and he gives generously. He gives generously to those who use generously what he has given to them, and these passages certainly teach that. 2 Corinthians chapters 8 and 9 talks about those in Macedonia who were laying by in store for the needy saints in Jerusalem, and in chapter 8 he says they gave even beyond their means. Here were folks that were poor, but the folks in Jerusalem were starving. And so what did those who were poor do? They gave an abundance of what they had to feed those who didn't have the necessities of life. Beyond their means is what they did. Well, the righteous do that. Now, question. If your children see you doing that, what are they going to grow up learning how to do? Yeah, that's what they'll do. So this is not just something that involves you. It's repeated in your seed. And the condition, of course, as we continue to walk in God's ways, this is the quality of the character. It means something to you. Now, David made observation of that. Never seen the righteous forsaken, nor his seed begging bread. But what I have seen is that those who have not, they're very gracious with what they have, and his seed is blessed. Isn't that an observation we need to take home? Look at the next couple of verses or so. Beginning in verse 27. Verse 27. The writer says, depart from evil and do good, and dwell forevermore. For Jehovah loveth justice and forsaketh not his saints. They are preserved forever, but the seed of the wicked shall be cut off. There it is again. You see, over and over and over again. The righteous shall inherit the land and dwell therein forever. Now, I've got some other psalms on the board that I want you to maybe take a look at, but we might skip some of them. I want you to look, if you will, first at a New Testament passage in 1 Peter chapter 3. In 1 Peter chapter 3, there's a quotation. And in this quotation, it's from, if I understand it correctly, from Psalm 34 that we have on the board. So we'll just look at the quotation. In verse 8 beginning, 1 Peter 3, verse 8. Finally, be ye all like-minded, compassionate, loving as brethren, tender-hearted, humble-minded, not rendering evil for evil or reviling for reviling, but contrarywise blessing, for hereunto were ye called that ye should inherit a blessing. Now let's describe these people. What's happening in their lives? What are they experiencing? First Peter elaborates on this throughout.
Persecution.
Yeah. These that are receiving this epistle, they're suffering persecution. All right, so how are they to respond to it? Yeah, by giving, being tender-hearted, humble-minded, loving, not rendering evil for evil or reviling for reviling, but contrarywise, blessing. For hereunto were you called, that ye should inherit a blessing. Now here's the quote. Verse 10, for he that would love life and see good days, let him refrain his tongue from evil, and his lips that they speak no guile. Let him turn away from evil and do good. Let him seek peace and pursue it. For the eyes of the Lord are upon the righteous, and his ears unto their supplication, but the face of the Lord is upon them that do evil. Now you take that home and think about it. You're being ill-treated. People are persecuting you. You're trying to do what's right. What would be the way that the world would react to that? Get mad. Retaliate. He's had his day, now I have mine. His day will come. I'll take my own vengeance. Randy?
I was going to say, he's quoting from Psalm 34.
Yep.
That was the passage that the blind man in John 9 was familiar with.
Yeah. Isn't that interesting? Yeah. That's I hadn't thought of that. That's interesting. That's right. Yeah. Now, you want to love life and see good days? Even during a time when you're being persecuted, what do? Now we know this. What do? The whole Psalm 37 is all about it. If you want to love life and see good days and not just fret or become angry or worry yourself to death, what do? Trust in the Lord. That's right. You do what you know is right. You be compassionate toward others. You be loving toward others. You be tenderhearted toward others. Not rendering evil for evil. That's the way the world thinks. Pardon me?
This is like a recipe.
It is. It's exactly like a recipe. If you want to see good days, if you want to have a good life, then refrain your tongue from evil. Somebody says something ugly to you, what are you tempted to do? Well, we're going to say something of equal ugliness back. Isn't that right? And then he says, and his lips that they speak no guile, let him turn away from evil and do good. Now, let me illustrate. And then we'll talk about the why. There's a passage, again, that you're well familiar with in Romans, the 12th chapter, where in the third verse, he said, for I say through the grace that was given me to every man that is among you, not to think of himself more highly than he ought to think, but so to think as to think soberly as God dealt to each man a measure of faith. Don't elevate yourself. But isn't that the way of the world? I'm number one. If I don't do that for me, then nobody else will, right? Isn't that the way the world thinks? Well, you see, where does that lead? It leads to becoming your own vindicator. I'll get mine, all right? But what does the text tell us in verse 17? Well, you might even begin in verse 16. Be of the same mind one toward another. Set not your mind on high things, but condescend to things that are lowly. Be not wise in your own conceits. I know that's a whole lot of words, but you boil that down. Be not wise in your own conceits. What's he telling you? Don't brag on yourself. Don't think too highly of yourself. Verse 3, same thing.
Don't be conceited.
Yeah. And then, you'll note further in the text, I just lost my place.
17.
Thank you. 17. Render to no man evil for evil. Take thought for things honorable in the sight of all men. If it be possible, as much as in you lieth, be at peace with all men. That's expression, as much as it's possible. Raises the question, is it always possible to be at peace with all men? Well, no, Jesus wasn't. He tried to be, but what did they do to him? They killed him. So it's not always possible to be at peace with all men. But, he said in verse 19, avenge not yourselves, beloved, but give place unto the wrath of God, for it is written, vengeance belongeth to me. When Jesus was spoken against, well, how did he respond to that?
Didn't reply.
Now, I'll tell you what, brethren. It takes a whole lot of grit. We might even call it self-control, to use a Bible word, to keep your mouth shut. Don't it? When I was a little boy, I was in trouble with my mother. And she said something, and I felt like I needed to reply to it. And my dad reached around and patted me on the knee, and he said, son, it's time to keep your mouth shut. Dad didn't have to say something more than once. You didn't miss it. I knew what was coming. You don't fix this. And sometimes it just is. There's a time to keep silent. But when he says, render to no man evil for evil, take thought for things honorable in the sight of men, if it be possible, as much as in your life, be at peace with all men. Avenge not yourselves, beloved, but give place unto the wrath of God. For it is written, vengeance belongeth to me. I will recompense, saith the Lord. But if thine enemy hunger, if you feed him, or feed him, if he thirst, give him to drink. For in so doing, thou shalt heap coals of fire upon his head. Be not overcome of evil, but overcome evil with good. How many of you have siblings? How many of you fellows have a brother? Okay? You ever fight with a brother? Oh, I'm looking at Noah. No, I believe that's so. Yeah. My brother and I, when we would get into it over something, the inevitable statement that either he or I would make is, he hit me first. Any of you ever say that? He hit me first.
It's always true.
Well, and then what happened? The fight was on. All right. Now that's avenging evil for evil. That's what that is. He hit me first and I hit him back. But that's not what Romans tells us. And that's not what Peter tells us. And that's not what the psalmist tells us. You see. So there is a way to behave and there's a reason why. Because the Lord, he won't ever forsake his saints. And this would be a good place to pick up on this thought next time. All right. Thank you for your attention and your comments.